I should be done instead of beginning. I feel like I should be done instead of finishing. Welcome. As people file in. Oh, yeah, well. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. My name is Dave Lambert. I'm a longtime UU and a member of this fellowship for the last 3 years since we moved to Manhattan. Today, we focus on thanks. At this time of year, we and peoples around the world and throughout history have paused to give thanks for the gifts from the earth and the blessings from our family, friends, and community. Although our pains and our problems can be complex, today we recall the simple gifts of life, community, and love. Please join us in our stories of thanks. First of all, are there any new members or visitors to this morning's service? And if so, if you aren't too embarrassed, please bring recognition to yourselves or to those sitting next to you. No? Okay. Well, regardless, please welcome those around you. Please take a minute to say good morning. Good morning, Kathy. Yeah, I'm kind of up here by myself. Okay, all are welcome. All are welcome this morning. Let's see, the announcements, I'll go into those first. We have two announcements this morning. Uncle Lorenz will be the host of the final fellowship dinner on December 7th. And old and especially new UUs are invited to dinner. Uncle will have the details. Jim Chanteau has details, but he's not here this morning. And Ann Marchand, I don't know if Ann is here or not, but there's a sign up out in the narthex that you can sign up for that fellowship dinner on December 7th. And the first of many times I will be announcing this is all are welcome to join us for a soup brunch after the service this morning. As I said, I'll mention this several times through the service, but hopefully everybody can stay here for the lunch. I've asked Kathy to help us light the chalice this morning. The chalice is a cup, a symbol of sustenance, of the way we care and nurture one another in community, the way we hold and challenge one another to grow. The flame of our chalice is a symbol of wisdom and truth and of thanksgiving. It reminds us of the spark of the divine, the creative light, a flame in all creation and in every human heart. Thank you, Kathy. As we come to the close of this Thanksgiving weekend, pause and give thanks to all of our blessings. Please take this opportunity to share any special joys or blessings you would like to share with our community. Dick. Oh, there is a microphone. Here comes the microphone. Yeah.
We had some very distressing news a couple of days ago because our granddaughter, who's struggling with schizophrenia and affective disorder both, made a very serious suicide attempt and then thought better of it after a few hours and did tell her mother, who, of course, is dealing with lymphoma, and said, well, she couldn't do that to her mother. So she, after a number of days in the intensive care and now on a psychiatric ward, she's safe, and it looks like she's come through unscathed from it. And part of the that problem.
Thank you, Dick.
Larry Weaver, Dick's story reminds me of situations in my own life in which my son, who has some similar conditions, and attempted suicide, so I know where you're coming from. But in his case, one of the things I'm thankful for is that today he's past that. He's out of work, about to be divorced, but he's sober and mentally healthier than he's been in a long, long time. And for that, I am truly thankful. And your story reminds me vividly of just how thankful I am. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Bryce Hobrock. Shirley and I spent yesterday in Plainville, Kansas. How can you get much plainer than Plainville? Staging the birthday party for my mother, her 105th birthday party. And thanks to the supreme planning skills of my wonderful wife, it went off very well. And we had the right kind of crowd of relatives and things, and my mother soldiers on in pretty good condition, and so we were very grateful for the afternoon.
Shirley Hobrock, welcoming chair, and I would like to announce this morning that we have a few new members. Glenn Carey, would you stand up, Glenn? And Sabrina Bowker, who's been coming for a long time. And Sue Prey, would you stand up? Yes. Thank you.
My son Charles is back from living and working in Brazil for 5 years, so it's great to have him back for a while.
I'm Sylvia Beeman, and I'm really sympathetic for people that are having problems right now. Our family has its own variation of ups and downs, and today we have a really big up, which is our family's together for the first time in 4 years, almost 4 years. Naomi, Adrian, Irene, Thibault, and Chloe on the end. Sorry, Chloe, I didn't see you there.
Welcome. As I opened, I'll repeat the words. Although our pains and our troubles can be complex, today we recall the simple gifts of life, community, and love. I'd like to share a poem that Sybil pointed out to me that was in this this current issue of the UU World. It's entitled Meditation, written by Carol Bindel. We pause to give thanks for the voyage of life from seed to harvest, the kiss of rain and sun and growth, the gifts of the earth given into the hands of strangers, friends, and family, whose efforts now bring such bounty to our table. Thanks for this soft animal body that carries each life here present, so sturdy and yet so fragile. Thanks and praise for fellowship and for the lives of those whose essence lingers among us. Thanks for the complex ways we each continue to seek and find our place, unique like everyone else. Lead us to the gift of regular silence until it silences us. Bring us to choose gratitude until we are truly grateful. Fill us with praise until we ourselves become a consistent act of praise. So we give thanks for all things, including joys and sorrows, deeply felt, but left here unspoken. As I said, we're going to have several announcements of our soup this morning, and we're going to open up with a recipe that is being followed in the kitchen as we speak. Larry is going to lead us in a rendition of Stone Soup, and the children are welcome.
Although they were going home, they were still far from home. So they had a long way to go. It was not real cold. It's about this time of year. So it was not real cold, but it was sort of cold. And they were hungry. And they didn't have any food or money, but they saw a village up ahead, so they went to the village. They went to the first door, the house they came to, and went to the door and knocked. The door opened, the man came there, and one of the soldiers said, "We'd be happy to clean out your pig shed if we could have some food with you tonight." The man said, "No, I only have enough for my family," and closed the door. So they walked on to the next house. This time, a woman opened the door. "We'd be glad to clean out your chicken coop if we could share a meal with you tonight." "No, I only have enough for me and my family." Close the door. Third house. This time, a little boy came to the door. And they said, "Are your parents here?" And he said, "Yes, I'll get them." So the parents came to the door. And they said, the soldier said, "We'd be happy to clean out your barn if we could share a meal with you tonight." "No, I'm sorry," they both said. "Harvest was bad this year. We only have enough for us and our family." Close the door. So the soldiers walked on. And as they walking down the street to it, move your legs back a little bit to make room for the soldiers. Here they come. As they walked down the street, they saw a little girl and a little boy. And the children said, "Where are you going?" And they said, "Well, we're going home, but it's a long way." "Well, what are you going to do tonight?" "Well, tonight we're going to the woods to make some stone soup for our supper." "Stone soup?" said the little boy and the little girl. "How do you make soup out of a stone?" "Well," said the soldier, "we have a very special stone." And they walked on, and the little boy and the little girl looked at each other, and they said, "We've got to see this." This we've got to see. And so secretly, they followed the soldiers back to the woods. Now, when the soldiers got to the woods, they built a fire. And they built a fire right about there. So would you move back a little bit so we don't get burned? That's it. Okay. They built a fire. They had a small pot with them. They put a rock in the pot out of their pack that they had in their pack. They had this rock. They put it in the pot. They put water in the pot from the stream right by there and then set it on the fire. Pretty soon the water got hot and the bubbles started coming up. And the soldier said, that smells good. Well, the kids couldn't stand it anymore. They had to go up there and smell it too. And you know what? It did smell very faintly, very faint smell. But you know, you kids have sharp senses of smell. And they could smell it. Wow. And that stone soup? Yes, said the soldiers. It is just stone soup, but it really would be better with a potato. And the kids said, I know where we can find a potato. And they ran home. Now, on the way, when they got into the village, they met a little girl, one of their friends. And she said, what are you doing? We're getting a potato to go put in some stone soup. Stone soup, said the little girl. What's that? Some soldiers in the woods are making it, and it smells wonderful. So the kids got a potato, and now the three of them ran back to the soldiers. The soldiers were singing a little soldier song there, smelling their stone soup. Oh, wow, they said when the kids came back with the potato. That's a big potato. It'll go great with our stone soup. And so they chopped it up, put it in the pot, and the water came back to a little bubble. And now it really did begin to smell some pretty good, and it was not a faint smell anymore. Ah, said the soldiers, it is just stone soup, but it really would taste better with a carrot or two. And the little girl that came with him said, I know where we can get a carrot. And the soldier said, and if there's a carrot, then it'll need to be a bigger pot. And she said, oh, I can bring that. So the three kids ran home, and the little girl got a carrot. In fact, she got two. And she got a bigger pot. And they ran back to the woods. Ah, said the soldiers, that's great. So they took the small pot with the rock and the potatoes in it, and they poured it all into the big pot, including the rock and the potatoes. Then they added some water to the small pot and swirled it around to get all of the goodness, poured that into the big pot, and put the big pot on the fire. And pretty soon it was bubbling again. Oh, wow, it smells good. The soldier said, yes. It's just stone soup, but it really would taste better with an onion and maybe a larger pot. So they ran back to the village, and they met a little boy there. And they came back with a larger pot and an onion. And now it was bubbling, and the onion was in there, and it was smelling wonderful. And the soldier said, it's just stone soup, but it really would be better with some meat or peas. And the kid said, we'll have to tell our parents about this. So they ran back, and they told their parents, and here's what they said. It is just stone soup, but it smells wonderful. The parents said, this we've got to see. The parents came back with them, And my gosh, it did smell wonderful. And the parents said, I can bring some meat and peas and a larger pot. That'll overflow what you've got there. So the parents went back, and on their way they met more villagers and told them about this wonderful stone soup. The villagers came, they poured it into a big pot, and eventually they had, you better move back because it's such a big pot, that there was enough really for the whole village. They added the peas, they added the meat, they stirred it, and then, of course, the mothers had remembered you need bowls. And the fathers had remembered spoons. And soon the villagers were sharing the stone soup. They were singing. They were laughing. They had a marvelous time. But eventually it was over. They had eaten the stone soup. And it was time to go home to bed. And so the villagers went home. The children went home. They took the villagers took the large pot. The soldiers had just the small pot. But they put the rock from the small pot, the rock from the that was now in that large pot. They had put it in back into their small pot. They put it into their knapsack, and they went their way. Now, there's a point to this story. There's a thing to remember from this story. And the thing to remember is that no one brought much, but almost everybody brought a little. And that's the way we can cooperate in community and have a good time, a happy time, instead of saying, well, there's just enough for me and my family. Okay? So that's our story of stone soup, and we'll have some later.
Go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere. I'm not sure I've mentioned it, but we will be sharing some of that stone soup after the service this morning. We'll be accompanied for this morning's offertory by original music performed by Dick Meeban on his thingamajig, the didgeridoo. Didgeridoo. So please share as you are able of our plenty with those in need and to help support our spiritual home. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dick. I believe that's a first. This morning's service addresses Thanksgiving. We're coming to the end of the Thanksgiving weekend. The sermon is unashamedly stolen from a sermon that was presented by Scott Alexander a year ago. Scott Alexander is a UU minister at Barrow Beach, Florida. And this morning's words are drawn largely from this sermon that he has posted. So join me as we put on our time traveler rings and we travel back to the fall of 1621, to the windswept shores of Plymouth Harbor. Imagine our small village, rough family lodges in the wilderness, surrounded by the skeletal remains of the summer's garden and of the leafless trees. Winter approaches, not on soft kittens' feet, but crunching noisily towards us, foretelling months of gloom. Picture the first American Thanksgiving feast, which our Pilgrim forebears shared with their Native American neighbors on these rocky shores. Many imagine this to be a pleasant and a peaceable scene, a rather rosy view depicted in elementary school displays and in hundreds of Hallmark greeting cards. Well-dressed pilgrims and proud Indians congenially gathered under the brightly colored trees, sharing a large table groaning with the fruits of the harvest, thanking their respective gods for life's copious blessings, and enjoying a carefree day of companionship. This is the myth that has grown up around that first Thanksgiving. The reality was far different and far more painful. The only accurate element of the Hallmark Thanksgiving is the genuine friendship and goodwill that apparently existed between the Englishmen and Englishwomen and their immediate Native American neighbors in that fall of 1621. The rest of the story is tragic and brutal. The Pilgrims first drop anchor in Provincetown Harbor on November 11th, 1620, about a year earlier, after a two-month voyage from England. After several weeks of first exploring and then giving up on the capabilities of the spit of land at the end of the Cape Cod Peninsula to support a settlement, the Pilgrims sailed across Cape Cod Bay to what is currently known as Plymouth. And yes, there is a rock there, by the way. The Pilgrims were in a religious sect fleeing persecution in their homeland. They were called separatists because they wanted to be completely separate from the Church of England These independent souls wanted to choose their own ministers democratically and run their own congregations. They insisted on local autonomy, just as Unitarian Universalists insist on local autonomy now. In fact, the Pilgrims' original church, the first parish in Plymouth, founded in 1620, is the oldest Christian church in America. It became a Unitarian church in the early 1800s and persists today as a Unitarian Universalist congregation. The circumstances resulting in this group of malcontents traveling to the New World were not very pleasant. William Bradford, the first governor of the new colony, describes what life was like for the separatists while they were still in England. This is William Bradford's words. "They cannot long continue in any peaceable condition, but were hunted and persecuted on every side, so as their former affiliates were but as flea bitings in comparison with those now that came upon them. Some were taken and clapped up in prison. Others had their houses beset and watched night and day and hardly escaped their hands. And the most were fain to flee and leave their houses and habitations and the means of their livelihoods. Yet seeing themselves thus molested and that there was no hope for their continuance there in England, by a joint consent, they resolved to go into the Low Countries, where they heard was freedom of religion for all. After a few years of relative safety and freedom in Holland, the separatists, fearing the assimilation of their young into Dutch culture and religion, decided that the only way to preserve their faith and their way of life was to immigrate to the New World, where they could set up a controlled community from which their children would not be able to stray. Apparently, cross-tribal romance was beyond possibility, though one might wonder about the potential for inbreeding. In November of 1620, when the little ship Mayflower reached landfall at Cape Cod, the 100 surviving men, women, and children on board were disappointed that they were not able to reach Virginia, which was their intended destination. They were 300 miles to the north of that more temperate environment. After a week or so on the exposed spit of land near Provincetown, Massachusetts, the settlers sailed across to the richly forested and protected mainland of Plymouth, where they hoped they could find food and safe harbor to ride out their first winter. The next few months were to prove a nightmare. There was very little to eat. They survived on small portions of salt beef and hardtack and native corn from a cache from which they helped themselves following their first landfall across the bay. Scurvy was widespread because of the absence of fruit and vegetables. Almost everyone fell sick, and fully half of the original 100 pilgrims, strangers, and Mayflower crew members died cold and horrible deaths before spring arrived. Again, William Bradford. So they died sometimes two or three a day, and of 100 and odd persons, scarce 50 remained. And of these, in the time of most distress, there was but 6 or 7, about the size of this first occupied pew, sound persons who, to their great commendations be it spoken, spared no pains, night or day, but with abundance of toil and hazard of their own health, fetched them woods, made them fires, dressed their meat, washed their loathsome clothes, clothed and unclothed them. In a word, did all the homely and necessary offices for them, which dainty and queasy stomachs cannot endure to be named. The historical record clearly shows that without the help of the local Poconoket Indians, who generously shared food with the pilgrims that first winter, and showed them how to plant and cultivate the native corn the next spring and summer, yes, there was a Squanto, and yes, there was herring involved, the colony would have certainly been wiped out by starvation and disease. Luckily for the 50 survivors, that first summer was a generous one. The harvest was so good that by fall of 1621, as Bradford put it, they were safely gathered in ere the winter storms began. And here is the part of the story where the abundance of spirit and community in the human soul takes form. In spite of all the hardships and horrors they had endured, in spite of what must have been their nearly bottomless grief and suffering, the surviving pilgrims decided to mark their good fortune to give thanks to God and to creation. They put on a 3-day blowout of food and festivities for themselves and their native friends, Chief Massasoit and about 90 other Pocanoquets. Again, Bradford's account of this first Thanksgiving. Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men out fowling so that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered the fruit of our labors. And although it may not always be so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish others to partake of our plenty. It's worth repeating Bradford's words. We are so far from want that we often wish others partake of our plenty. Let us not focus on the regrettably short-lived happy ending with the rich and peaceable feast, but the tougher, brutal first part, which was so systematically kept from us in elementary school. Ponder the absolute horror of that first Plymouth winter of 1620-21. By spring, no family was left untouched by the ravages of disease, despair, starvation, death. Imagine living in cold, dirty hovels, watching half the people you know and love perish because of natural forces beyond your control. There must have been so much suffering and sadness, we shiver just thinking of the manifold miseries they were forced to endure. We think of the pilgrims as resilient adventurers upheld by an unwavering religious faith, but in addition to the starvation, the cold, the despair, they were also people in the midst of what has always been and continues to be one of the most difficult emotional challenges a person can face: immigration and exile. It is spiritually important that we not romanticize that first American Thanksgiving as some carefree festival of reckless joy. With apologies to Hallmark and to countless elementary school teachers, the pilgrims seated at that first Thanksgiving were haggard survivors, exhausted men, women, and children, still thin, still weak, wearing little more than rags. Yes, they were grateful to have endured, to be sure, but looming over whatever happy feelings they mustered must have lingered incredibly deep measures of grief for their losses and fear for their earthly future. One can only imagine the depth of feeling as they gave thanks to their God at that harvest celebration. It's a miracle of the heart that those pilgrims could even think of giving thanks to God or celebrating life's bounty with their Pocanoquet neighbors. No one could have really blamed them if, as the first anniversary of their arrival in America approached, they had decided to hold a service of mourning for the dead and withdrawn into their own sadness in the gathering fall darkness. What makes the real Thanksgiving story so remarkable is not the joy which the pilgrims and their neighbors shared on that day, but rather that their painful backdrop of grief was not allowed to block out their celebration. What makes that first American Harvest Festival so nobly instructive is our remembering the profound depths of misery which preceded the pilgrims' decision to celebrate and to share. Somehow they were able to choose gratitude over bitterness, generosity over greed, and thanksgiving over self-pity. Soren Kierkegaard once observed, "It takes real courage to grieve, but it takes religious courage to rejoice." We have all known pilgrims. Time and again, we have met lovely, courageous individuals who also have answered unfathomable pain and tragedy with brave and gracious resolve. Behind this morning's shared joys and concerns are often stories from our friends' hearts of unfathomable pain. Scott Alexander, the author of the sermon that I'm drawing upon, speaks of one such pilgrim, Joe Russo. What he spiritually taught Scott about life and living is forever etched in Scott's heart. I'm going to repeat Scott's story because it is so meaningful. Joe Russo was a strapping 24-year-old who drove a bulldozer at the Memphis City dump until one day he suddenly fell down in the shower, never to walk again because of a rare degenerative neurological disease that quickly paralyzed most of his body. By the time Scott Alexander met him during the year he served as a chaplain at the City of Memphis hospitals, Joe, confined to a bed for almost 2 years, could move little more than his eyes. He even required a respirator because the disease had so weakened his chest muscles that he was unable to breathe. He could talk, but only by constricting the few remaining throat muscles available to him. When Scott first approached his door, it was, as you can guess, with much trepidation. He was sure that the unjust fate that had befallen him would make the visit sad and painful. How could a young man struck down by a cruel disease in the prime of his life not be angry, not be embittered? What comfort could anyone possibly bring to him? What Scott didn't know was that Joe was a Thanksgiving pilgrim. His little 10 by 15 foot room in the hospital was the spiritual and social center of the entire 2,000 bed hospital. By sheer force of personality and will, Joe refused to let his physical paralysis paralyze him spiritually or emotionally. The visitors, including his large and attentive Roman Catholic family, were legion. They came to sing and to read to Joe. His room was filled with flowers, silly doodads, and laughter from the latest joke. Joe had a rule that you could not come visit him unless you had preferably an off-color joke when you came. Refusing to focus for very long on himself and his troubles, Joe was tireless with his questions about Scott Alexander's day, Scott's plans, his love life, his ideas, his dreams, his opinions, and his prejudices. That tiny hospital room was one of the largest and loveliest human spaces that Scott had ever visited. He shall always remember those rich hours of conversation, prayer, and laughter with Joe, another Thanksgiving pilgrim. From Scott's story, Joe must have been a beautiful person. Joe chose to live fully and vibrantly, even when life had taken away most of what you and I think of makes life full and vibrant. He was still grateful for the gift of life and ready to live it as fully as he could. Without denying or trivializing the senseless tragedy which had befallen him, he chose hope over despair, community over isolation, laughter over tears, others over self, caring over indifference. Joe chose life over death. Joe was a pilgrim who taught others how to love life and to live. Kathy?
Well, I'd like to share a story with you about overcoming kryptonite, and this is about my favorite pilgrim, my sister Francie, with whom some of you have met. And I know I've played music from her CD several times over the years. My little sister Francie isn't someone you meet. She's someone you experience. Even shorter than I am, Francie has always been the family dynamo, like the center of a tornado, hurricane. Whirling into your environment and blowing away all your pretension and all the glums. And I've always thought of myself as fairly shy and quiet. I'm, in fact, the quietest member of my family. But that's because I've always compared myself to Francie. That's like thinking you're clumsy because you're dancing with Dame Margot Fontaine, or that you can't play the piano because you're playing next to Slavomir. I saw Francie she was a professional children's entertainer, and I saw her one time transform a rowdy community Thanksgiving crowd from chaos to quiet within 30 seconds of her walking on stage. There were hundreds of people in the room. I watched over 200 teachers huff and puff along with her and a nasty old wolf in her story. and whole auditoriums full of cynical middle school students melted in her hands. I taught at Fort Riley Middle School, and she came out there several times and performed, and they clamored for autographs when she finished. So one time we made copies of her PR photo and her autograph, and we handed them out. And 5 years later, we learned that a high school senior still had one hung over his desk. And once, after a performance, a four-year-old came up to her and said, "When it's time, I think I'll hire you for my wedding." And I swear that no one, not even Dick Clark, could get a crowd to hokey pokey like Francie. But now my favorite Tasmanian devil is in the fight of her life. After two decades-long career of professional storytelling and singing and accolades, including the Regional Emmy nomination, Parents' Choice Approval Award, California State Artist, and Sacramento Arts Educator of the Year, which you got just a month ago, she's being robbed. A thief, an undiagnosed neurological disorder, is stealing her strength. She says, "I feel like I'm Superman, suddenly surrounded by kryptonite." A woman who once played competitive tennis, rode her bike in 50-mile day trips, and emceed California State Fair stages in 100-plus degrees, Francie now struggles to walk unaided, must sit to finish a sentence, and has had to say goodbye to a career that sustained her and my two nieces. She lost her house, declared bankruptcy, and without a diagnosis cannot qualify for assistance. She continues to teach literature part-time at Sacramento State, which provides health insurance and a small income, but she can do little else. What she has not lost, however, is her indomitable spirit. I remember when she was about six, Francie was sleepwalking. She was dressed in a t-shirt and underpants, and she held her arms in front of her like a prize fighter. Her chin was jutted out, and she was mumbling something like, "Get 'em, get 'em." Though I was in seventh grade at the time, I remember stepping back and from this fierce little being and yelling for my mom to come wake her up, because I absolutely knew I wasn't going to tangle with her because I would lose. And this is the same pugnacious, persistent approach that Francie has toward her current situation. She does have difficult days, but she shares them with few. She's frustrated about not having a diagnosis, though the options, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease or muscular dystrophy, among others, are pretty scary. But she turns her doctors and her counselors into advocates, and they are fighting alongside her. And her community fights for her, too. Despite her initial reservations, friends organized a huge benefit for her at Fairytale Town, a regional park with Mother Goose characters dating back to the 1950s. You know, the kind where you turn the little key and you get a song and a story from the little box? Well, Francie is the voice in those boxes. And so they really do call her the voice of Fairytale Town. So they pulled all the community together to have a benefit, and they called it Celebrate Francie. So the organizers said, on November 2nd, they had a huge gathering, 500 to 600 people came to celebrate Francie. And the organizer said, "Francie touches people's hearts, and particularly the hearts of children. It was a no-brainer that people would want to come together for her. If you had to choose a person for which you're going to do something, you might as well choose someone that everybody loves, and everybody loves Francie." And suddenly, this woman who's very private when she's off stage, Francie became the center of a media whirlwind. There were newspaper interviews, radio spots, flyers, huge signs. The whole community suddenly knew of Francie and her disorder and her struggles to overcome them. But what they didn't count on, however, was how deeply touched that they would be by this woman that they describe as perennially perky. And I'd like to share with you a couple of pieces written by Francie and for others in regional publications, including the Sacramento Bee. And I'll believe they'll show you why I'm so thankful to have this resilient woman in my life. There's one thing she said in the Sacramento Bee. "I've come to realize that it's not all about this," she, Francie, said, gesturing to her lower body. "I'm not sure the kids care so much about it." She signed on for a couple of small events at Fairytale Town in the coming year. She'll bring her stool, she said, and perform with every ounce of energy she has left. In the future, her performance venues will be more intimate, her acts much less dynamic, but her commitment to children will continue until her body gives out. I want them to know that I didn't choose to stop performing, she said. I loved every minute of it. It was glorious. And then she added in the Mount Valley Community News, she knows she has more to give. I can't believe that the universe is willing to let me just dissolve without making further contributions. I can't believe that this is the plan. I believe I've got something to give that will benefit and be of service, and now it's my job to discover that. This benefit will give me breathing room to make that happen, and to me, it is the greatest gift of all to discover what that is. The last thing that I want to share with you is the ending of the letter that she sent out to those who donated at her celebration. She says, here is a YouTube link to a Rascal Flatts song that I play every time I get in the car. Because the truth is, I do love my life, every part of it. And truthfully, the life lessons I've learned, the love you have all extended to me, I've learned the love that you have extended to me may never have had the opportunity to be fully expressed if I wasn't here, right now, with what is. And I wouldn't trade that feeling and life awareness, for anything in the world. If possible, I might have asked the universe to find another way of teaching me this, but being what it is, I am truly grateful. I love you all, and thank you for bringing me back to life. And thank you, Francie, for what you've added to mine.
Thank you, Kathy. Viktor Frankl is another pilgrim. Dr. Frankl survived the Auschwitz concentration camps and offers its lessons. The experiences of death camp life show that one does have a choice of action. One can preserve a vestige of spiritual freedom, of independence of mind, even in such terrible conditions of psychic and physical stress. Everything can be taken from us but one thing, the last of the human freedoms to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. It is this spiritual freedom which cannot be taken away that makes life meaningful and purposeful. So this Thanksgiving season, remember all of our blessings and be thankful. Remember those brave survivors at Plymouth who, enveloped in sorrow and grief, laid out a generous feast of gratitude and sharing. Remember all those brave and beautiful souls that you have known who have refused to let life's inevitable adversity or pain rob them of purpose and joy. And lastly, dear friends, remember that beneath your very real grief and losses, life's holy heartbeat can still be heard. No matter what has been taken from you, there is still life to be vibrantly, bravely, purposefully lived. Amidst the many thorns of living, there is always, always joy to be discovered, beauty to be seen, laughter to be heard, service to be accomplished, satisfaction to be found, love to be shared, and mountains to climb. Please share your own stories of Thanksgiving pilgrims you have known and loved.
I'm not going back to Francie again. But I just had this wonderful story when we lived in northern Louisiana, and we'd been away from all of our families and friends. It was 1965 in a small town in northern Louisiana, and we were all Yankees, so it was not a good situation. But my cousins decided to come down and be with us, and at the time we were all pretty, it was... money was really, really tight. But my cousins came all the way down from Colorado to the northern Louisiana. And I remember I was all crammed inside this little tiny house. And my mom pulled the turkey out of the oven. And it was this beautiful, gorgeous turkey. And we were so excited. And we were all there together. And it was wonderful. And she set the turkey down on the table. And all the meat fell off the bones and just fell onto the plate. I remember we all just stood around staring at this naked carcass and just not really quite sure what to do about it. But still, when we're in the family, if anything gets a little dull, all anybody has to do is mention that Thanksgiving turkey, and it brings back all those happy memories again. And to me, that's a favorite family story of just being thankful for being together, even though the turkey looked nasty.
Other stories to share?
This is a story when I lived in France, and we missed Thanksgiving. We were there I was there for 2 years, there were a number of us Americans there. And they don't celebrate Thanksgiving in France, you know. And so we figured out that somehow we could get a restaurant to help us, you know, as far as, I don't know. I can't remember all the details. I just remember that we were all really excited about this. I mean, it was like missing Christmas or something at that time. And nothing tasted the same. I mean, actually it was kind of like a potluck and restaurant thing. They just kind of gave us a table. They felt sorry for us or something, because we were all kind of in there saying, do you think you can make a pumpkin pie? I mean, is there some way, because none of us had something. You know, we lived in places where we didn't even have stoves or whatever, because we were just a room or something. So, I don't know, I realized at that time just how important Thanksgiving was, and it was something and all the other Americans, which weren't too many, but it was just really a very important holiday to be thankful for.
Bent, who had come over after the war, had lived, of course, during the German occupation in the Netherlands, and through the last winter, what they call the hunger winter, they ended up eating tulip bulbs. This is all they had to eat. So when he came over here just before the Thanksgiving. And of course, Europe doesn't celebrate Thanksgiving. And this was one of his favorite holidays. He was so thankful and enjoyed it. And every Thanksgiving, he gave thanks. It was one of his favorite holidays. It's a wonderful time. And I remember him and his joy.
Well, I remember Thanksgivings from my childhood and all that. My dad would cook a gigantic turkey and all that. One thing I always loved was I was the only one allowed in the kitchen. He taught me how to cook mostly during Thanksgiving dinner and other times. And nowadays, when I give a Thanksgiving dinner, I find people who don't have family or someone nearby, and I say, come on over, eat. So I'm very thankful that I had the opportunity to do some good works by inviting people over.
Thank you. Pat and Dick, do you want to lead us? Our closing hymn is "'Tis a Gift to Be Simple." It's number 16 in the gray hymnal. Stand as you're able. And we'll let you guys want to take a verse or warm us up? Or okay.
Gift to be simple, tis a gift to be free, tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't ashamed. To turn will be our delight, till by turning we come round right.
For infinite possibilities, for this tenuous gift of life and community, for this season of Thanksgiving, let your hearts sing with Carl Sandburg. Call hallelujah. Call amen. Call deep thanks. Amen.
Hallelujah.
Thank you, Sylvia. Please join us for soup.